Memorials of the Faithful by Abdu'l-Bahá. Your reader is Mary Ellen Baker. This is Tape 1, Side 1. This quote is from the dust cover of the book. This book by Abdu'l-Bahá, translated into English half a century after his passing, was a labor of pure love, both in its remembrance of the faithful ones who expended their lives in the path of Baha'u'llah, and to the present and future generations of readers. Although in outward form it is a collection of brief biographical sketches, they do not concern the personal transitory aspects of human life. It is the quality of soul, the attributes of spirit, the quintessential humanity, and the reflection of the divine in man that is the focus here. Those who are commemorated here share one thing in common. They are impelled by their love for Baha'u'llah. So great is this magnetic force in their lives that they travel vast distances and overcome all barriers to be with him and to share his prison life. Despite peculiarities of time and place, the reader will recognize the timeless, universal human types: princes and paupers, professors and illiterates, mystics and merchants, clerics and feminists, artisans and peasants, each arrive by their own spiritual route, and by their example teach us how to live and how to die. Abdu'l-Bahá says almost nothing about himself in this book, but occasional events in the lives of these companions are interwoven with his own, and we have glimpses of that essence of humanity and humility that was his. His observant, warm, and tender love surrounds these faithful ones, and through them fills us with the same qualities. This is a book to be savored slowly, allowing the figurative language to create its own spirit, as these words of Abdu'l-Bahá trace the shape of the valley of love and faithfulness. Proem. This is a book about people who were trying to get into prison rather than to escape from it, because they were prisoners of a great love. Their love was for Baha'u'llah, whom the 19th century world bound with chains and tried to silence by shutting him, ultimately, in the Crusaders' stronghold at Akka. Like the eye of the storm, he is the center of these accounts, but hardly appears in them, remaining, as the Guardian has described him, quote, transcendental in his majesty, serene, awe-inspiring, unapproachably glorious, unquote. The reader will probably find himself in these pages, whether he is the jeweler from Baghdad, one of the dishwashers, or the professor who could not endure the arrogance of his compeers. Mystic, feminist, cleric, artisan, merchant, prince are here. Even modern Western youth will be found here, for example, in the chapter on dervishes. For this is more than the brief annals of early Baha'i disciples. It is somehow a book of prototypes, and it is a kind of testament of values endorsed and willed to us by the Baha'i exemplar, values now derided, but, if the planet is to be made safe for humanity, indispensable. These are short and simple accounts, but they constitute a manual of how to live and how to die. The task of putting these biographies into English was given me by the Guardian many years ago when I was on a pilgrimage to the Baha'i World Center in Haifa. Shortly after, the Guardian sent me to Tehran, the text from which this translation was made. According to its Persian title page, this was the first Baha'i book to be printed in Haifa under the guardianship. A Persian introduction states that Abdu'l-Bahá wrote the book in 1915 and granted permission to M.A. Karubai to have it published. The text, which is dated 1924, bears the seal of the Haifa Baha'i Assembly. A second title page, in English, describes the work as, quote, an account from the pen of Abdu'l-Bahá of the lives of some of the early Baha'i believers who passed away during his lifetime, unquote, although the work was actually recorded from his utterances. Here, then, almost half a century after his passing, is a new book given to the world by Abdu'l-Bahá. We wonder how many of us, at the close of unbelievably painful and arduous years, would devote the waning time not to our own memories, but to the lives of some 70 companions, many of them long dead, to save them from oblivion. Abdu'l-Bahá was present at many of these scenes, yet time after time he effaces himself to focus on some companion, often on one so humble that the passing years would surely have refused him a history. And if, to the cynical, these believers seem better than ordinary men, we should remember that the presence of the manifestation made them so, and that they are being looked at through the eyes of the Master, who said that the imperfect eye beholds imperfections, and that it is easier to please God than to please people. Thus the book is still another token of Abdu'l-Bahá's partiality for the human race. The love he personified was not blind, but observant, not impersonal, but warm and tender. It was a continual attitude of unobtrusive care. Such love from such a being does not end with one lifespan. He left the world half a century ago, and most of those who longed for him so much that the hostile said they were not Baha'is, but Abdu'l-Bahá's, are now vanished from our sight. But still his love is here for new millions to find. The translator, Keene, New Hampshire, December 1969. Nabil Yakbar. There was in the city of Najaf, among the disciples of the widely known Mojtahid, Sheikh Murtaza, a man without likeness or peer. His name was Akh Muhammad E. Khaini, and later on he would receive from the manifestation the title of Nabil Yakbar. This eminent soul became the leading member of the Mojtahid's company of disciples. Singled out from among them all, he alone was given the rank of Mojtahid, for the late Sheikh Murtaza was never wont to confer this degree. He excelled not only in theology, but in other branches of knowledge, such as the humanities, the philosophy of the Illuminati, the teachings of the mystics and the Sheikhi school. He was a universal man, in himself alone a convincing proof. When his eyes were opened to the light of divine guidance and he breathed in the fragrances of heaven, he became a flame of God. Then his heart leapt within him, and in an ecstasy of joy and love, he roared out like Leviathan in the deep. With praises showered upon him, he received his new rank from the Mojtahid. He then left Najaf and came to Baghdad, where he was honored with meeting Baha'u'llah. There he beheld the light that blazed on Sinai in the holy tree. Soon he was in such a state that he could rest neither day nor night. One day, on the floor of the outer apartments reserved for the men, the honored Nabil was reverently kneeling in the presence of Baha'u'llah. At that moment, Haji Mirza Hassan Amu, a trusted associate of the Mojtahids of Karbala, came in with Zainul Abidin Khan, the Fakhrul Dali. Observing how humbly and deferentially Nabil was kneeling there, the Haji was astonished. "Sir," he murmured, "what are you doing in this place?" Nabil answered, "I came here for the same reason you did." The two visitors could not recover from their surprise, for it was widely known that this personage was unique among Mojtahids and was the most favored disciple of the renowned Sheikh Murtaza. Later, Nabil Yakbar left for Persia and went on to Khorasan. The Amil Kain, Mir Alam Khan, showed him every courtesy at first and greatly valued his company. So marked was this that people felt the Amir was captivated by him, and indeed he was spellbound at the scholar's eloquence, knowledge, and accomplishments. One can judge from this what honors were accorded to Nabil by the rest, for, quote, "men follow the faith of their kings," unquote. Nabil spent some time thus esteemed and in high favor, but the love he had for God was past all concealing. It burst from his heart, flamed out, and consumed its coverings. Quote, "A thousand ways I tried my love to hide, but how could I upon that blazing pyre not catch fire?" Unquote. He brought light to the Khain area and converted a great number of people, and when he had become known far and wide by his new name, the clergy, envious and malevolent, arose and informed against him, sending their calumnies on to Tehran, so that Nasiruddin Shah rose up in wrath. Terrified of the Shah, the Amir attacked Nabil with all his might. Soon the whole city was in an uproar, and the populace, lashed to fury, turned upon him. That enraptured lover of God never gave way, but withstood them all. At last, however, they drove out that man who saw what they did not, and he went up to Tehran, where he was a fugitive and homeless. Here his enemies struck at him again. He was pursued by the watchmen. Guards looked everywhere for him, asking after him in every street and alley, hunting him down to catch and torture him. Hiding, he would pass by them like a sigh of the oppressed, and rise to the hills, or again, like the tears of the wronged, he would slip down into the valleys. He could no longer wear the turban denoting his rank. He disguised himself, putting on a layman's hat, so that they would fail to recognize him and would let him be. In secret, with all his powers, he kept on spreading the faith and setting forth its proofs, and was a guiding lamp to many souls. He was exposed to danger at all times, always vigilant and on his guard. The government never gave up its search for him, nor did the people cease from discussing his case. He left then for Bukhara and Ishkabad, continuously teaching the faith in those regions. Like a candle, he was using up his life, but in spite of his sufferings, he was never dispirited. Rather, his joy and ardor increased with every passing day. He was eloquent of speech. He was a skilled physician, a remedy for every ill, a balm to every sore. He would guide the Illuminati by their own philosophical principles, and with the mystics he would prove the divine advent in terms of inspiration and the celestial vision. He would convince the Sheikhi leaders by quoting the very words of their late founders, Sheikh Ahmad and Sayyid Kazim, and would convert Islamic theologians with texts from the Quran and traditions from the Imams who guide mankind aright. Thus he was an instant medicine to the ailing and a rich bestowal to the poor. He became penniless in Bukhara and a prey to many troubles until, at the last, far from his homeland, he died, hastening away to the kingdom where no poverty exists. Nabil-e Akbar was the author of a masterly essay demonstrating the truth of the cause, but the friends do not have it in hand at the present time. I hope that it will come to light and will serve as an admonition to the learned. It is true that in this swiftly passing world he was the target of countless woes, and yet all those generations of powerful clerics, those sheikhs like Murtaza and Mirza Habibullah, and Ayatollah Khorasani and Mullah Asadullah Mazandarani, all of them will disappear without a trace. They will leave no name behind them, no sign, no fruit. No word will be passed down from any of them. No man will tell of them again. But because he stood fast in this holy faith, because he guided souls and served this cause and spread its fame, that star, Nabil, will shine forever from the horizon of abiding light. It is clear that whatever glory is gained outside the cause of God turns to abasement at the end, and ease and comfort not met with on the path of God are finally but care and sorrow, and all such wealth is penury and nothing more. A sign of guidance, he was an emblem of the fear of God. For this faith he laid down his life, and in dying, triumphed. He passed by the world and its rewards. He closed his eyes to rank and wealth. He loosed himself from all such chains and fetters, and put every worldly thought aside. Of wide learning, at once a mujtahid, a philosopher, a mystic, and gifted with intuitive sight, he was also an accomplished man of letters and an orator without peer. He had a great and universal mind. Praise be to God, at the end he was made the recipient of heavenly grace. Upon him be the glory of God, the All-Glorious. May God shed the brightness of the Abha Kingdom upon his resting place. May God welcome him into the paradise of reunion and shelter him forever in the realm of the righteous, submerged in an ocean of lights. is Malahul Azdak. Among the hands of the cause of God who have departed this life and ascended to the supreme horizon was Jinabi Ismula Azdak. Another was Jinabi Inabili Akbar. Still others were Jinab Imula, Ali Akbar, and Jinab I Sheikh Muhammad Rizay I Yazdi. Again, among others, was the Reverend Martyr Achmir Zavarcha. Ismulahul Azdak was truly a servant of the Lord from the beginning of life till his last breath. When young, he joined the circle of the late Sayyid Kazim and became one of his disciples. He was known in Persia for his purity of life, winning fame as Mullah Siddiq the Saintly. He was a blessed individual, a man accomplished, learned, and much honored. The people of Khorasan were strongly attached to him, for he was a great scholar and among the most renowned of matchless and unique divines. As a teacher of the faith, he spoke with such eloquence, such extraordinary power, that his hearers were won over with great ease. After he had come to Baghdad and attained the presence of Baha'u'llah, he was seated one day in the courtyard of the men's apartments by the little garden. I was in one of the rooms just above that gave onto the courtyard. At that moment, a Persian prince, a grandson of Fath Ali Shah, arrived at the house. The prince said to him, "Who are you?" Ismullah answered, "I am a servant of this threshold. I am one of the keepers of this door." And as I listened from above, he began to teach the faith. The prince at first objected violently, and yet in a quarter of an hour, gently and benignly, Jinabi Ismullah had quieted him down. After the prince had so sharply denied what was said, and his face had so clearly reflected his fury, now his wrath was changed to smiles, and he expressed the greatest satisfaction at having encountered Ismullah and heard what he had to say. He always taught cheerfully and with gaiety, and would respond gently and with good humor, no matter how much passionate anger might be turned against him by the one with whom he spoke. His way of teaching was excellent. He was truly Ismullah, the name of God, not for his fame, but because he was a chosen soul. Ismullah had memorized a great number of Islamic traditions and had mastered the teachings of Sheikh Ahmad and Sayyid Kazim. He became a believer in Shiraz in the early days of the faith, and was soon widely known as such. And because he began to teach openly and boldly, they hung a halter on him and led him about the streets and bazaars of the city. Even in that condition, composed and smiling, he kept on speaking to the people. He did not yield. He was not silenced. When they freed him, he left Shiraz and went to Khorasan, and there, too, began to spread the faith, following which he traveled on, in the company of Babul Bab, to Fort Tavarsi. Here he endured intense sufferings as a member of that band of sacrificial victims. They took him prisoner at the fort and delivered him over to the chiefs of Mazinderan to lead him about and finally kill him in a certain district of that province. When, bound with chains, Ismullah was brought to the appointed place, God put it into one man's heart to free him from prison in the middle of the night and guide him to a place where he was safe. Throughout all these agonizing trials, he remained staunch in his faith. Think, for example, how the enemy had completely hemmed in the fort and were endlessly pouring in cannonballs from their siege guns. The believers, among them Ismullah, went 18 days without food. They lived on the leather of their shoes. This, too, was soon consumed, and they had nothing left but water. They drank a mouthful every morning and lay famished and exhausted in their fort. When attacked, however, they would instantly spring to their feet and manifest in the face of the enemy a magnificent courage and astonishing resistance and drive the army back from their walls. The hunger lasted 18 days. It was a terrible ordeal. To begin with, they were far from home, surrounded and cut off by the foe. Again, they were starving. And then there were the army's sudden onslaughts and the bombshells raining down and bursting in the heart of the fort. Under such circumstances, to maintain an unwavering faith and patience is extremely difficult, and to endure such dire afflictions a rare phenomenon. Ismullah did not slacken under fire. Once freed, he taught more widely than ever. He spent every waking breath in calling the people to the kingdom of God. In Iraq, he attained the presence of Baha'u'llah, and again in the most great prison, receiving from him grace and favor. He was like a surging sea, a falcon that soared high. His visage shone, his tongue was eloquent, his strength and steadfastness astounding. When he opened his lips to teach, the proofs would stream out. When he chanted or prayed, his eyes shed tears like a spring cloud. His face was luminous, his life spiritual, his knowledge both acquired and innate, and celestial was his ardor, his detachment from the world, his righteousness, his piety, and fear of God. Ismullah's tomb is in Hamadan. Many a tablet was revealed for him by the supreme pen of Baha'u'llah, including a special visitation tablet after his passing. He was a great personage, perfect in all things. Such blessed beings have now left this world. Thank God they did not linger on to witness the agonies that followed the ascension of Baha'u'llah, the intense afflictions, for firmly rooted mountains will shake and tremble at these, and the high towering hills bow down. He was truly Ismullah, the name of God. Fortunate is the one who circumambulates that tomb, who blesses himself with the dust of that grave. Upon him be salutations and praise in the Abha realm. Mullah Ali Akbar. Yet another hand of the cause was the Reverend Mullah Ali Akbar. Upon him be the glory of God, the All-Glorious. Early in life, this illustrious man attended institutions of higher learning and labored diligently by day and night until he became thoroughly conversant with the learning of the day, with secular studies, philosophy, and religious jurisprudence. He frequented the gatherings of philosophers, mystics, and sheikhis, thoughtfully traversing those areas of knowledge, intuitive wisdom, and illumination. But he thirsted after the wellspring of truth and hungered for the bread that comes down from heaven. No matter how he strove to perfect himself in those regions of the mind, he was never satisfied. He never reached the goal of his desires. His lips stayed parched. He was confused, perplexed, and felt that he had wandered from his path. The reason was that in all those circles he had found no passion, no joy, no ecstasy, no faintest scent of love. And as he went deeper into the core of those manifold beliefs, he discovered that from the day of the Prophet Muhammad's advent until our own times, innumerable sects have arisen, creeds differing among themselves, disparate opinions, divergent goals, uncounted roads and ways, and he found each one, under some plea or other, claiming to reveal spiritual truth, each one believing that it alone followed the true path. This, although the Muhammadic sea could rise in one great tide and carry all those sects away to the ocean floor. Quote, "No cry shalt thou hear from them, nor a whisper even," unquote. Quran 19:98. Whoso ponders the lessons of history will learn that this sea has lifted up innumerable waves, yet in the end each has dissolved and vanished like a shadow drifting by. The waves have perished, but the sea lives on. This is why Ali Khabili Akbar could never quench his thirst till the day when he stood on the shore of truth and cried, quote, "Here is a sea with treasure to the brim. Its waves toss pearls under the great wind's thong. Throw off your robe and plunge, nor try to swim. Pride not yourself on swimming. Dive headlong." Unquote. Like a fountain, his heart welled and jetted forth. Meaning and truth, like soft-flowing crystal waters, began to stream from his lips. At first with humility, with spiritual poverty, he garnered the new light, and only then he proceeded to shed it abroad. For how well has it been said, quote, "Shall he the gift of life to others bear, who of life's gifts has never had a share?" Unquote. A teacher must proceed in this way. He must first teach himself, and then others. If he himself still walks the path of carnal appetites and lusts, how can he guide another to the evident signs of God? That was from the Quran 3:91. This honored man was successful in converting a multitude. For the sake of God, he cast all caution aside as he hastened along the ways of love. He became as one frenzied, as a vagrant, and one known to be mad. Because of his new faith, he was mocked at in Tehran by high and low. When he walked through the streets and bazaars, the people pointed their fingers at him, calling him a Baha'i. Whenever trouble broke out, he was the one to be arrested first. He was always ready and waiting for this, since it never failed. Again and again he was bound with chains, jailed, and threatened with the sword. The photograph of this blessed individual, together with that of the great Amin, taken of them in their chains, will serve as an example to whoever has eyes to see. There they sit, those two distinguished men, hung with chains, shackled, yet composed, acquiescent, undisturbed. Things came to such a pass that in the end, whenever there was an uproar, Mullah Ali would put on his turban, wrap himself in his abba, and sit waiting for his enemies to rouse and the feroces to break in and the guards to carry him off to prison. But observe the power of God. In spite of all of this, he was kept safe. Quote, "The sign of a knower and lover is this, that you will find him dry in the sea," unquote. That is how he was. His life hung by a thread from one moment to the next. The malevolent lay in wait for him. He was known everywhere as a Baha'i, and still he was protected from all harm. He stayed dry in the depths of the sea, cool and safe in the heart of the fire, until the day he died. After the ascension of Baha'u'llah, Mullah Ali continued on, loyal to the testament of the light of the world, staunch in the covenant which he served and heralded. During the lifetime of the manifestation, his yearning made him hasten to Baha'u'llah, who received him with grace and favor and showered blessings upon him. He returned then to Iran, where he devoted all his time to serving the cause. Openly at odds with his tyrannical oppressors, no matter how often they threatened him, he defied them. He was never vanquished. Whatever he had to say, he said. He was one of the hands of the cause of God, steadfast, unshakable, not to be moved. I loved him very much, for he was delightful to converse with, and as a companion, second to none. One night, not long ago, I saw him in the world of dreams. Although his frame had always been massive, in the dream world he appeared larger and more corpulent than ever. It seemed as if he had returned from a journey. I said to him, "Jinab, you have grown good and stout." "Yes," he answered, "praise be to God, I have been in places where the air was fresh and sweet, and the water crystal pure. The landscapes were beautiful to look upon, the foods delectable. It all agreed with me, of course, so I'm stronger now than ever, and I have recovered the zest of my early youth. The breaths of the All-Merciful blew over me, and all my time was spent in telling of God. I have been setting forth his proofs and teaching his faith." Unquote. The meaning of teaching the faith in the next world is spreading the sweet savors of holiness. That action is the same as teaching. We spoke together a little more, and then some people arrived, and he disappeared. His last resting place is in Tehran. Although his body lies under the earth, his pure spirit lives on, quote, "in the sea of truth, in the presence of the potent king," unquote. Quran 54:55. I long to visit the graves of the friends of God. Could this be possible? These are the servants of the Blessed Beauty. In his path they were afflicted. They met with toil and sorrow. They sustained injuries and suffered harm. Upon them be the glory of God, the All-Glorious. Unto them be salutation and praise. Upon them be God's tender mercy and forgiveness. Sheikh Salman. In 1266 A.H., that is 1849 to 1850, the trusted messenger Sheikh Salman first heard the summons of God, and his heart leapt for joy. He was then in Hindiyan. Irresistibly attracted, he walked all the way to Tehran, where, with ardent love, he secretly joined the believers. On a certain day, he was passing through the bazaar with Akh Muhammad Taqi I Khashani, and the Farishes followed him and discovered where he lived. The next day, police and farrashes came looking for him and took him to the chief of police. "Who are you?" the chief asked. "I am from Hindiyan," replied Salman. "I have come to Tehran and am on my way to Khurasan for a pilgrimage to the shrine of Imam Riza." "What were you doing yesterday?" the chief asked, "with that man in the white robe?" Salman answered, "I had sold him an abba the day before, and yesterday he was to pay me." "You are a stranger here," the chief said. "How could you trust him?" "A money changer guaranteed the payment," Salman replied. He had in mind the respected believer Akh Mohammadi Sarraf, money changer. The chief turned to one of his farashes and said, "Take him to the money changers and look into it." When they reached there, the farash went on ahead. "What was all this," he said, "about the sale of an abba and your vouching for the payment? Explain yourself." "I know nothing about it," the money changer replied. "Come along," said the farash to Salman. "All is clear at last. You are a Babi." It happened that the turban which Salman had on his head was similar to those worn in Shushtar. As they were passing a crossroads, a man from Shushtar came out of his shop. He embraced Salman and cried, "Where have you been, Khaji Muhammad Ali? When did you arrive? Welcome." Salman replied, "I came here a few days ago, and now the police have arrested me." "What do you want with him?" the merchant asked the farash. "What are you after?" "He is a Babi," was the answer. "God forbid," cried the man from Shushtar. "I know him well. Khaji Muhammad Ali is a God-fearing Muslim, a Shia, a devout follower of the Imam Ali." With this, he gave the farash a sum of money, and Salman was freed. They went into the shop, and the merchant began to ask Salman how he was faring. Salman told him, "I am not Khaji Muhammad Ali." The man from Shushtar was dumbfounded. "You look exactly like him," he exclaimed. "You two are identical. However, since you are not he, give me back the money I paid the farash." Salman immediately handed him the money, left, went out to the city gate, and made for Hindiyan. When Baha'u'llah arrived in Iraq, the first messenger to reach his holy presence was Salman, who then returned with tablets addressed to the friends in Hindiyan. Once each year, this blessed individual would set out on foot to see his well-beloved, after which he would retrace his steps, carrying tablets to many cities, Isfahan, Shiraz, Khashan, Tehran, and the rest. From the year 69 until the ascension of Baha'u'llah in 1309 A.H., Salman would arrive once a year, bringing letters, leaving with the tablets, faithfully delivering each one to him for whom it was intended. Every single year throughout that long period, he came on foot from Persia to Iraq or to Adrianople or to the most great prison at Akha, came with the greatest eagerness and love, and then went back again. He had remarkable powers of endurance. He traveled on foot as a rule, eating nothing but onions and bread, and in all that time he moved about in such a way that he was never once held up and never once lost a letter or a tablet. Every letter was safely delivered. Every tablet reached his intended recipient. Over and over again in Isfahan, he was subjected to severe trials, but he remained patient and thankful under all conditions, and earned from non-Baha'is the title of the Babi's Angel Gabriel. Throughout his entire life, Salman rendered this momentous service to the cause of God, becoming the means of its spread and contributing to the happiness of the believers, annually bringing divine glad tidings to the cities and villages of Persia. He was close to the heart of Baha'u'llah, who looked upon him with especial favor and grace. Among the holy scriptures there are tablets revealed in his name. After the ascension of Baha'u'llah, Salman remained faithful to the covenant, serving the cause with all his powers. Then, as before, he would come to the most great prison every year, delivering mail from the believers and returning with the answers to Persia. At last, in Shiraz, he winged his way to the kingdom of glory. From the dawn of history until the present day, there has never been a messenger so worthy of trust. There has never been a courier to compare with Salman. He has left respected survivors in Isfahan who, because of the troubles in Persia, are presently in distress. It is certain that the friends will see to their needs. Upon him be the glory of God, the All-Glorious. Unto him be salutations and praise. Mirza Muhammad Ali, the Afnan. In the days of Baha'u'llah, during the worst times in the most great prison, they would not permit any of the friends either to leave the fortress or to come in from the outside. Skew Cap, Akhajan, and the Siyid Muhammad, the Antichrist of the Baha'i Revelation, lived by the second gate of the city and watched all there at all times, day and night. Whenever they spied a Baha'i traveler, they would hurry away to the governor and tell him that the traveler was bringing in letters and would carry the answers back. The governor would then arrest the traveler, seize his papers, jail him, and drive him out. This became an established custom with the authorities and went on for a long time, indeed for 9 years, until, little by little, the practice was abandoned. It was at such a period that the Afnan, Haji Mirza Muhammad Ali, that great bough of the holy tree, journeyed to Akka, coming from India to Egypt, and from Egypt to Marseille. One day I was up on the roof of the caravanserai. Some of the friends were there with me, and I was walking up and down. It was sunset. At that moment, glancing at the distant seashore, I observed that a carriage was approaching. "Gentlemen," I said, "I feel that a holy being is in that carriage." It was still far away, hardly within sight. "Let us go to the gate," I told them. "Although they will not allow us to pass through, we can stand there till he comes." I took one or two people with me, and we left. At the city gate I called to the guard, privately gave him something, and said, "A carriage is coming in, and I think it is bringing one of our friends. When it reaches here, do not hold it up, and do not refer the matter to the governor." He put out a chair for me, and I sat down. By this time the sun had set. They had shut the main gate, too, but the little door was open. The gatekeeper stayed outside. The carriage drew up. The gentleman had arrived. What a radiant face he had! He was nothing but light from head to foot. Just to look at that face made one happy. He was so confident, so assured, so rooted in his faith, and his expression so joyous. He was truly a blessed being. He was a man who made progress day by day, who added every day to his certitude in faith, his luminous quality, his ardent love. He made extraordinary progress during the few days that he spent in the most great prison. The point is that when his carriage had come only part of the way from Haifa to Acha, one could already perceive his spirit, his light. After he had received the endless bounties showered on him by Baha'u'llah, he was given leave to go, and he traveled to China. There, over a considerable period, he spent his days mindful of God and in a manner conformable to divine good pleasure. Later he went on to India, where he died. The other Revered Afnan and the friends in India felt it advisable to send his blessed remains to Iraq, ostensibly to Najaf, to be buried near the holy city, for the Muslims had refused to let him lie in their graveyard, and his body had been lodged in a temporary repository for safe keeping. Akha Syed Azdullah, who was in Bombay at the time, was deputized to transport the remains with all due reverence to Iraq. There were hostile Persians on the steamship, and these people, once they reached Bushehr, reported that the coffin of Mirza Muhammad Ali, the Babi, was being carried to Najaf for burial in the Vale of Peace, near the sacred precincts of the shrine, and that such a thing was intolerable. They tried to take his blessed remains off the ship, but they failed. See what the hidden divine decrees can bring about? His body came as far as Basra, and since that was a period when the friends had to remain in concealment, Syed Asadullah was obliged to proceed as if he were going on with the burial in Najaf, meanwhile hoping in one way or another to effect the interment near Baghdad. Because, although Najaf is a holy city and always shall be, still the friends had chosen another place. God, therefore, stirred up our enemies to prevent the Najaf burial. They swarmed in, attacking the quarantine station, to lay hold of the body and either bury it in Basra or throw it into the sea or out on the desert sands. This is page 18. This memorial will continue on side 2. Please turn the tape.